Yo, neighbors, welcome back to the Strange Neighborhood podcast. And holy shit. Have you ever had like fate come along, just like knock your fucking front teeth down your throat? Because, yeah, it happens. It happens. It might be around the next corner, friends and neighbors. You just never know. But the important thing is, I'm back here with you. And I'm ready to stick around for a while, do some episodes, visit with you, share, get weird. And so this episode is going to be about where the fuck I have been. And obviously, because it's me, we're going to put a little Alan Watts on the end. So that we have a better time understanding the chaos of life in the long run. The bigger picture. So we could see the bigger picture. Yeah. So glad to have you back. I hope you enjoy this episode. It's not like super fun subject matter, but I don't know. It's important. Maybe relatable. And if you're back, I really hope you're back next week again, and I'm glad to be here, doing what I like. Beginning of September, I made an episode called Suffering Joyfully, Lessons in Happiness. And the universe sure fucking delivered me some suffering so I could put my money where my mouth is, I guess. I guess that's what it did. I guess that's what it always fucking does, doesn't it? I should have shut my big fucking mouth. I have to go around talking about how happy I am and how easy it is to be happy.
True love is hard to find. Sometimes you think you have true love and then you catch the early flight home from San Diego and a couple of new people jump out of your bathroom blindfolded like a goddamn magic show ready to double team your girlfriend and it stops.
Sometimes you take the early flight home from San Diego and you find out your whole life's a lie and you pack up and fucking take off from it. So it's been a weird month. It's been a real weird month. Wild. Life is crazy. So I don't know, maybe we'll just fucking get into it here. Lay it all out. I've been putting off making this episode because I know I just don't know how to talk about it. I just don't know how to put into words like everything that just happened in my life. You never really know anyone. I'm going to tell you that. You got to get to know yourself really well and remember that you could always count on yourself because life is wild. So just a little tiny speck over a month ago. I think it was like October 4th or 5th or just before Canadian Thanksgiving. I'd moved down to live at the beach or at the lake house on Vancouver Island. It was so beautiful. I was like, you know, there was things going on in my life that were like challenging me at the time, but not really what I thought like I was living the dream there. Like, we packed up all our shit. I got rid of so much of my shit. And then we moved to Vancouver Island to this beautiful lake house, me and my husband and my daughter. And shortly after, a month ago. So we've been there for like 2 months. Not even. No. We've been there for like a month and a half. Fuck. I don't know. I caught my husband having an affair. I'm just gonna fucking say it. Like a massive one. And it had started where we previously lived. With some. I'm gonna just try and not like sound petty here. Just lay the facts out. Because I could get real heated. I could get real heated about this. But yeah. I mean, whatever. It happened. And it continued down there after, which is fucking wild. And it's pretty extensive and pretty, yeah, complex external relationship that was going on. So I think like I packed everything I had and left the guy within 40 minutes. I was out the door and never looked back. He didn't even get home from his rendezvous that I caught him in. So it's fucking crazy when something like this happens. It's been like, been with him since I was 25 years old. And like the insane amount of shock it put me in, and like the way it just like severed me from being present to myself in that moment is something I can't stop thinking about. And for like a period, quite a long period after. I don't know if this is even interesting to listen to. But it happened. So some things I've learned a little bit. I learned around this short period of shocking time. You never really know anyone. You don't. You can't. People don't even know themselves. They could like people could always surprise you, but they surprise themselves too. So people will always surprise you for good or for bad. And another thing I learned is like reach out to people. It's so hard for us to like share vulnerable moments with each other or be like, I'm going through this fucking garbage and like say it in detail. Like we're trying to protect the way people perceive us or our relationships or our strengths or weaknesses. But you just like get yourself in this stuck place, like living outside of reality a bit when you don't reach out to people or like embrace your support system or the people that love you and let them help you and let them be there for you. Had a lot of walls built before this that have like come down pretty quickly. And that's been like an important lesson for me. And then another lesson I learned is when people show you who they really are or how they really feel, believe them. Don't try to talk yourself out of it. Rationalize it and understand it. Sometimes there's things you can't understand. And you still have to like move on from them, and you still have to like make your life good after. Without understanding, without having any answers, without having any real insight. No one ever answering fully the question why. It's hard for people to not have answers to these kind of questions. It's hard for you to ask these questions and then have someone say they don't know why. Another lesson I learned is that some things in life are like just so fucking painful. Like you feel like you're being fucking destroyed from the inside out. You can't fathom sitting with that pain. You can't fathom what you're going to do with all the things you feel in you. It's just like fucking so overwhelming. And it just takes you out like a fucking tidal wave. And you ask yourself, like, why? How? Like, what is the point of suffering like this? What is the point of the depths of this suffering? We want to know why, like, but sometimes, like, you don't get to know why, but what I've learned about the suffering and the pain is that it catalyzes, or it's a catalyst for like something so monumentally great that there's no possible way you could find your way there until you feel the depths of that destruction first. I don't know if that makes sense. It like is meant to be like a, I think, fuck. I think it's meant to be like a catapult into something. And sometimes I think like there's like some cosmic perfection arranging itself through this fucking tear in my heart. And sometimes I'm just like, this is fucking chaos. Like, but I don't have the answers to why life is so painful and we can suffer so deeply. But I do feel like the suffering and the despair and the destruction was like a birthplace of something that maybe is like even better than I ever imagined. And maybe this is just how everything was meant to be. Maybe I did have like the greatest love of all time, but maybe it had an expiration date. Or maybe I was stuck in a place of thinking I did have the greatest love of all time, but there's more to things than that. There's more things to come than that. And that experience was meant to bring me to here, and now I'm here. And I really hope I just hope here is going to be as good as it's starting to feel. Because listen, a month ago, almost to the day, I felt like lower than I could possibly ever imagine feeling. Like I never felt something so painful. Ever. But today, it's a month later, and I have like so much joy in a way, and like optimism and calm and strength in me that like a month ago I could have never imagined. And just like, let's be clear here, like I've been seeing a therapist, like right away I started seeing a trauma therapist. And like, I know everyone says this, like it's therapy, but like, oh my God, everyone should do therapy. Like, it's just I think like the space I've moved to emotionally since everything happened is just, it's come a lot quicker than I think it could have on my own by having someone help me through it. And I just feel like so much expansion and abundance and in my life and everything around me. And I'm just like, trying to embrace things as they come and just be joyful and I have like this fucking insane lust for adventure right now, and so I'm gonna start adventuring. I'm going to be Dora the fucking Explorer. And I think that's, I don't know what direction this is going to take me, but I'm remembering some like old part of me that just like was driven for adventure and wanted to just like experience everything and say yes to everything and just like had a joy for life and was excited about everything. And I could like feel that bitch in the background. Like, and I forgot about her kind of. And she is really fun. So I'm just going to have fun. I'm going to have fun for a while, guys. I'm going to forget about my marriage, I guess. 14 years with someone is a really long time. But I'm going to let that go with love and just hope for the best for me and my ex and my daughter going forward and just work hard at that, just making it the best, just doing my best, having a joyous, beautiful life, all the adventure. I'm not gonna keep living like I used to. And I think that's kind of a gift. I'm not about to like thank my ex for that sweet gift, but I think I'm at a point where I can thank the universe for the gift of like renewal, rebirth. It's the story of the phoenix in it. Yeah, I don't know what else I want to say about that. I think like I was talking to my friend Katie we check in with each other's lives. And it's like my friend I've never met that lives in Texas is moving to Florida, which is so exciting. But we were talking about how happiness, like I said in that other episode, when I was super thinking I was super happy. Happiness isn't like a stagnant state or like a steady state. It ebbs and flows. And I don't, and like she said, and like I agree, like I don't think we're just meant to be like steadily happy. Like we're not, life isn't meant to be lived in like just a happy state, because there's so much like beautiful texture in the other parts, the lows, the challenges, the destruction. Hopefully that you guys can hear the dishwasher, but it's being really loud right now. But whatever. This is my new little house. I moved into a little house with my daughter, and it's really magical, but it's small, so you can't get away from the sounds of the things going on. I just, yeah, so me and Katie were talking about how like the life is like a, it's like a challenging path, but we're always thinking like we'll get something out of things once we reach something. But I think the point is to learn to get something out of things as we're reaching for something. Like in every moment, every challenge, every just any point of life or any in between time. Like that's where we need to find joy, like in each moment, in each thing. And like I think something else I learned is that if you're not fully being yourself and embodying yourself and truly being like I thought I was doing these things, but I was being a bit people pleasy, but if you're not being completely authentic as yourself and showing up in the world as yourself, one day the universe is gonna fucking knock you over the head because the universe is like conspiring constantly to bring you to that state of like authentic self, lovingly authentic self. Like being just true to you and your own heart and everything. So I think like everything's conspiring to like draw you to that place of just falling in love with yourself and then just embodying self all the time. We get caught up in designing a facade a little bit, or like a mask or a costume, so that it we get our needs met and it satisfies the people around us. But it's really self-destructive, actually. It's You can never reach your full potential. You can never reach your ideal life. You can never see what all the universe has like wanted to provide you and give you and shower down on you and all the abundance in your life if you're like not showing up as yourself. So be brave. Be fucking brave and be yourself. It's scary. It's scary because we all have these like abandonment fears. And then, so when you embody yourself and someone rejects that, it's so painful. But pain, there's good things in pain too, remember? But when you're like trying, when you're being like a weird persona that's not your authentic self and someone rejects it, it's not as painful because that's not even like the true essence of you that they're rejecting. So you keep that little part of you private, and It protects you from the pain of being rejected or abandoned. But abandonment is a gift too, I found out. Like a big gift, because it reminds you that you're always there to catch yourself, and you're always there to pull yourself up. And when you do that, when you can like have your life turn into a dumpster fire and like put the fire out yourself and fucking figure it out and clean the shit up and like get everything back together, you know that like you're kind of impervious to pain, or in a way, like you always have you, and there's nothing really that can take that away from you. You always have you. So learn to love you. Learn it. And when you think you know it, reach deep inside yourself, because I promise you, there's parts of you that you haven't learned to love yet. And if you don't, the universe is going to put you in a circumstance that helps you learn to really appreciate those parts. And sometimes those circumstances aren't fun at fucking all. I'll tell you. Sometimes you'd rather have been hit by a fucking bus than deal with the lesson the universe is giving you. So I don't know what else to say about that, I guess. C'est la vie. Like, such is life. You never know what's coming around the next corner. And all of our people pleasingness and like creating these external visions of ourselves to present to the world, it's not stopping what's coming around the corner. Nothing is. You gotta let the river flow, I guess, and then see what happens. Hopefully make the best of it, and then learn maybe to make the best of other things and every moment. Maybe not every moment, but like most fucking moments.
Put the picture down. Put that down. Just discuss this. I love her, man. I know. Look. Listen to me. We think the world of Sarah. We think she's great. Okay? But, I'm just being honest here. Every time she would come over to our house, she always acted, you know, like a little bitch. Okay, pump the brakes.
Dating Sarah is not like dating Liz, okay?
You guys want to hear some kind of strange detail? When I met my now ex-husband, the first movie we watched together was Forgetting Sarah Marshall. That's where the clip's from. And like, it was like my favorite movie ever since. I just thought it was so fucking funny, and I liked it so much, and we watched it together tons. And then somehow I turned into Peter Brenner, and then my life ended up just like it. Maybe I haven't met Mila Kunis yet, but or maybe I have, but you know, it's really weird. I mean, almost the same, but it played out a lot the same. So that's fucking weird. I can just relate to that guy so much in the movie now. Okay, so I think that went really good. Just like breaking the ice so I could like get back to podcasting and not feel like I'm like hiding some weird extreme detail. from the experience. I don't know, like if this, if you want, if this happened to you or you are going through stuff like this and you want someone to talk to, like come find me on Instagram, Strange Neighborhood Podcast on Instagram. Because yeah, reaching out to others is like the main thing that helped me through this. And I just want you guys to know that I could have really, really, really shit talked the guy today into the ground, but I chose to be the bigger person. And you know what's great about my life is that I just have to be the bigger person all the time. You could just get really fucked over. And I think like being a parent, then you just have to, I mean, obviously not all parents choose to be the bigger person. But for me as a parent, it made it. So like the choice was taken for me. Like I'm an example for my daughter. And if I want her to be a good person in the world, that's what I got to be. And yeah, it sucks. The choices, all my choices were taken from me and made for me. And then I just had to pick up this, clean up this mess, but and be the bigger person. But you know what? Like, in the end, I was the bigger person. I was, I don't know, like as one of my friends said, like, you are excellent at divorce. It's therapy, I swear. Thanks for listening to my rambling. I'm sure it wasn't super entertaining. And maybe there'll be further details in other episodes. But I just wanted you guys to know that, like, I guess I haven't been here because I moved like 2,000 miles away, got rid of all my stuff, found all this out, packed up all my measly amount of shit I had down there, left my life, my pets, my husband, and like my future dreams sitting there, and caught the ferry back and went back to my hometown with my daughter. And we got a little house and, we're starting fresh. So here's the fresh starts and deep lessons. And I'm going to pass it over to Alan Watts just so you guys got more than a half hour. And he always has something that's like relevant for the situation to say to help you feel like more zen about life and like feel like you're part of a divine plan instead of like an insane chaos. So I love you guys. Thanks for listening. And we're going to get back to like our normal weird selves and do some good episodes coming up. So yeah, stick around.
This morning, I'm going to talk to you about a particularly virulent and dangerous form of divine madness, which is called falling in love. Which is, from a practical point of view, one of the most insane things you can do, or that can happen to you. Because in the eyes of a given woman or a given man, an opposite who, though to the eyes of everybody else a perfectly plain and ordinary person, can appear to be a god or goddess incarnate, to be such an enchantment that one can say in the words of an old song which probably dates me, every little breeze seems to whisper Louise. And this is an extraordinarily disruptive experience, a subversive experience in the conduct of human affairs. Because you never know when it will strike or for what reason. It's something like contracting a very chronic disease once you get into it. And we try to resolve it sometimes by making it the basis for a marriage. which is an extraordinarily dangerous thing to do. And this is because in Western civilization, we have a tradition of the family, which is very curious, and which would seem to be the most ridiculous composition of disparate ideas imaginable. When we go back to the origins of Western civilization in the Hebrew and Christian traditions, we find that the idea of marriage and the experience of falling in love are really rather separate things. Because in those earlier times, in agrarian cultures, nobody ever chose their marriage partner. There are certain exceptions to this, that in ancient Greece, you occasionally find a woman who is called a Parthenos, which has been mistranslated virgin. The correct meaning of Parthenos is a woman who chooses her own husband. And there were very few of them. And in that passage in the Gospel, in the book of the prophet Isaiah, where it says, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel," that is in Greek, Parthenos, a Parthenos shall conceive. And it therefore has nothing strictly to do with a virgin, although a woman who chooses her own husband might conceivably be a virgin. But by and large, a marriage was an alliance of families. And it was contracted not simply for the purpose of raising children, yes, but also to create a social unit smaller than a village. A village, therefore, being a cluster of families. And these families were rather large. So families allied. The oldsters, the grandpa and grandma, who had an enormous voice in who their children were going to marry, used to, as you know, I suppose this is no news to any of you, used to dicker and use go-betweens. And they considered not only whether this girl was suitable for their son and vice versa, but also what kind of a dowry she would bring, whether it would be advantageous to the two families to form such an alliance. And of course, these things, almost up to quite recent times, were always important in the marital affairs of royal families. But as is notorious, all royal families and kings and queens kept concubines and had outside arrangements when and if they should happen to fall in love. And even if they didn't, they had mistresses simply to prevent monogamy from becoming monotony. So that is the basis, you see, and that is why to this day marriage is a civil or and or religious ceremony, the basis of which is a contract, a legal contract, which one signs on the dotted line. And therefore there are all kinds of laws, as laws relate to contracts, that this contract is very difficult to get out of. The rationale for that being quite obvious, that society believes that it requires a secure environment for children, but also just the general stability of things. Because when people break up a marriage, it's sort of unnerving for everyone. You see a couple and you think for a long time that they're the happiest and best adjusted couple you ever met. The next thing you know is that they've split up. And you begin to think, now what goes on here? Are all my friends crazy? Because you see people breaking up all around. Of course, you call it breaking up. That's a put-down phrase, to break up. Especially, it sounds like smashing something, as if something precious had been smashed. Whereas it may be something quite different altogether, depending on how you evaluate it. But now, into this kind of feudal conception of marriage, there came in very largely, I think, as a result of the poetic movement that was centered in southern France, in Provence, in the Middle Ages, what is called the cult of courtly love. This is something about which scholars dispute. According to one theory, the knightly or courtly lover, who was also a poet, would select a lady to be his heart's desire, preferably a married lady. And he would yearn for her and sing songs under her window and send messages to her and little tokens of his devotion. But according to this particular theory, he must never go to bed with her. Not only would that be adultery, but it would spoil the state of being in love. That it should always be an unfulfilled state and an unhappy state. This is the theory of Denis de Rougemont in his book Love in the Western World, or Passion and Society. It has two titles. And the other theory is probably more realistic, that this was, first of all, the great ladies of the noble families were awfully bored because their husbands were always out hunting and making war and wenching and so on. And therefore, they had to have lovers too. And so they did indeed have adulterous affairs on the side. And a great deal of poetry rose out about this. Because you see, it's my friend Janko Varda always says that laws about sexual relationships should never be liberalized. There should always be strict disapproval of adultery and fornication, because if there is not that strict disapproval, and if it's not difficult to attain, it's less fun. And I have worked out, those of you who've read my book, Beyond Theology, I've worked out a whole theory of the Christian repression of sex, that the secret intent of this was to make people more interested in sex. Because if there is complete liberality and promiscuity in every direction, it all becomes so easy that it might indeed be in danger of becoming a bore. And then people would seek other dissipations of perhaps a less healthy kind. So then, as a result of the gradual fusion of these two approaches to the relationship of the sexes, we have arrived at the idea of the romantic marriage, in which the two trends are misallied, to say the very least. You are supposed, therefore, to fall in love with someone, and of your own choice, naturally. It has to be that way if you're going to fall in love, if that is a choice. And then enter into that relationship with a legal contract in which you get up before a magistrate or a priest and do solemnly curse and swear that you will be faithful to each other until death do you part. Which leads often to murder. And it seems to me perfectly obvious that two young people who are extremely anxious to get into each other's embraces, and the only way of doing so under the circumstances is entering into this contract, will naturally be ready to promise anything to fulfill this desire. And while there are indeed many, many married, legally married couples who have a very, very happy alliance that goes on all their lives, and we don't hear about them because good news is never news. It's only the unhappy couples who make the newspapers. And there are enormous numbers of them, but they are mainly, I think, people who were lucky. There is no way of making a marriage work, so far as I know, because every attempt to make a marriage work is secretly within the breast of each partner builds up hostility. You can, I know all this, I'm speaking from a certain amount of bitter experience. You can work very hard to keep a marriage together. And as you do so, you may fail to recognize, you see, that you are being untrue to your own emotions. And you think, well, I must control my emotions for the sake of children, for the sake of society, for the sake of everything like that. And so you work and work, and one of the ways of working is to try to convince yourself that you're in love. And you go through the pretenses of love. You hypnotize yourself with loving language towards your partner. You go out of your way, you make little lists to remember attentions you must pay. You keep a diary in which you remember your wedding anniversary, because you were very liable to forget it. And all these things, and you really work it. Now, the more you work it, the more you're building up promises and expectations for something that you are probably not going to come through with at the level of deep feeling. And everyone is well aware of that, is a Hintergedanke. You know it in the back of your mind. And so you build yourself increasingly into a wall-to-wall trap. And so the mutual hostility grows worse and worse and worse, so that one psychologist was recently known to ask a patient, with whom are you in love against? The most awkward form of falling in love is between people who are already married to someone else. And because, you see, this is a cataclysmic and disruptive experience in our present social order. And we know of, I mean, Victorian novels. A lot of people are still living out Victorian novels. But in Victorian novels, the great thing is where a couple madly in love with each other say to each other, well, it's best for us that we don't see each other anymore. This is becoming bigger than either of us, you know. And so this fantastically mad experience is denied, swept under the rug, and strangled. What should one do? Well, as I've often said, I'm not a preacher, and therefore I don't know what you should do. But I would like to make some reflections on this particular form of madness and to raise again a very disturbing question. And this disturbing question is as follows. Is it only when you are in love with another person that you see them as they really are? And in the ordinary way, when you're not in love with people, you see only a fragmented version of that being. Because when you're in love with someone, you do indeed see them as a divine being. And suppose that's what they are truly. And your eyes have by your beloved been opened. In which case, your beloved is serving to you as a kind of guru, an initiator. And that is why there is a form of sexual yoga, based on the idea that man and woman are to each other as mutual guru and student. And through a tremendous outpouring of psychic energy in total devotion and worship to this other person, who is respectively the goddess or the god, you realize by total fusion and contact with the other organism, you go down to the divine center in them, and it bounces back, and you discover your own. Or you could put it in this way, which is another aspect of it, that by falling in love, and regarding falling in love not just as a sort of sexual infatuation, because it's always more than that, isn't it? I mean, you can have great sexual enjoyment with a pleasant friend, you know, but you may do so simply because he or she appeals to your aesthetic senses. But when you fall in love, it's a much more serious involvement. You just cannot forget this person. You feel miserable when not in their presence. You're always yearning, let's get see more of each other, let's get together, let's we're completely entangled. And then you see, you've actually, a kind of a, what I will call spiritual element has been introduced. And the Hindus were sensible enough to realize that this was a means of awakening, enlightenment, and therefore it was surrounded with a sort of religious, ritual, meditative art, with a form of sexual yoga that is designed to allow the feeling of mutual love to the extent of grand passion to have an extremely fitting fulfillment and expression. Falling in love is a thing that strikes like lightning and is therefore extremely analogous to the mystical vision. We don't know how really people attain the mystical vision. There is not as yet a very clear rationale as to how it happens. Because we do know that it is opened to many people who never did anything to look for it. Many people, especially in adolescence, have had the mystical vision all of a sudden, without the slightest warning, and with no previous interest in that kind of thing. On the other hand, many people who have practiced yoga or Zen disciplines, or what you will, for years and years and years, have never seen it. And in both classes, there are, of course, exceptions. There are those who have never had the spontaneous experience, and there are those who, through yoga or Zen, have attained this insight. But as yet, we are not clear as to why it comes about. And if there is any method of attaining it, the best one is probably to give up the whole idea of getting it. But you see, it is completely unpredictable. And so it is, in that way, like falling in love, capricious, and therefore crazy. But if you should be so fortunate as to encounter either of these experiences, it seems to me to be a total denial of life to refuse it. And what we therefore have to admit in our society so that we can contain this kind of madness, we must be far more realistic about the marriage arrangement so that it can contain the possibility of falling in love. When you base marriage, you see, on falling in love, and you go into a pseudo-love affair, which is simply hot pants, and set up a rigid family in which you expect of the other person that they will always be in love with you. And then, in that context, you go and fall in love. Then your falling in love is of necessity disruptive of the marriage and of the family. But you see, it could only disrupt it because the love relationship between the two partners was false, was pretended. But if marriage were based more on the old idea of the reasonable contract between two people to bring up children, who are maybe expected at the best to be good friends, and to allow each other to be persons, that is to say, in the ordinary sense of the word person, to have their own freedom, then if love strikes, It is tolerated within this arrangement. Provided you not go to be so unreasonable as to go on to say, well, since I've fallen in love with somebody else, I must marry them. Well, that's perfectly ridiculous. Now, you see, in this way, we can think about and structure the necessary stable social institution of family of some kind without it being constantly threatened of foundering on the rocks of love. Now, you see, this then means that when people marry, if they take any vows at all to each other, instead of saying that they will always be true to each other in the sense of meaning, I will always love you, it means I will be true to you in the sense of I will always be truthful to you. I will not pretend that my feelings towards you are other than what they are. Because I marry you because I think that you are a reasonable person to live with, and therefore I want you to be you. I don't want you to be someone else. I want you to be a rubber stamp of me. How boring that would be. So it is an arrangement, not of, as we always say jocularly, did you get the ball and chain on him? But an arrangement in which people set each other free and make an alliance to cooperate with each other in certain ways. Now, if it should so occur that they are of immense sexual attraction to each other, so much the better. But this should not be a primary factor in entering into marriage. Admittedly, you must be, to a certain extent, attractive to each other, otherwise there will be no progeny. But but this seems to me to be a sensible and reasonable view. And just because it is sensible and reasonable, it can accommodate what is not sensible and reasonable, which is falling in love. We should regard then marriage, especially if it should possibly be called holy matrimony, as a mutual setting free of two people to live together in freedom and therefore in responsibility. Because the present situation, although it's pretending to be responsible, is in fact extremely irresponsible. Because it is dishonesty with respect to the way you feel towards another person. Well, now really, when we go back then to falling in love and say, it's crazy. Falling. You see? We don't say rising into love. There is in it the idea of the fall. And goes back, as a matter of fact, to extremely fundamental things. That there is always a curious tie at some point between the fall and the creation. Taking this ghastly risk is the condition of there being life. You see, for all life is an act of faith and an act of gamble. The moment you take a step, you do so on an act of faith because you don't really know that the floor is not going to give under your feet. The moment you take a journey, what an act of faith. The moment you enter into any kind of human undertaking and relationship, what an act of faith. See, you've given yourself up. But this is the most powerful thing that can be done. Surrender. See? And love is an act of surrender to another person. Total abandonment. I give myself to you. Take me. Do anything you like with me. See? So, that's quite mad. Because, you see, it's letting things get out of control. All sensible people keep things in control. Watch it, watch it, watch it. Security, vigilance, watch it. Police, watch it. Guards, watch it. Who's going to watch the guards? So, actually, therefore, the course of wisdom, what is really sensible, is to let go, is to commit oneself, to give oneself up, and that's quite mad. So we come to the strange conclusion that in madness lies sanity. The strange